The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Despite the quadrennial criticism of the New Hampshire presidential primary, candidates this year are embracing the Granite State and our tradition of voting first in the nation. There's no shortage of contenders here week after week, looking to meet voters on the job, in coffee shops, at festivals and fairs, house parties, and anywhere else they can press the flesh. Still, despite the folksy photo ops at country stores, it's clear the primary has changed as other states have gained early slots on the nominating calendar, as the national parties aim to control the process, and as all that special interest money from groups outside the state flows in. Our guests today have observed all these shifts with a realist's eye, but also a deep appreciation for what this unique tradition means. We're talking this hour with UNH scholars Andy Smith and David Moore. They're co-authors of the brand new book just released yesterday called The First Primary, New Hampshire's Outsized Role in Presidential Nominations. That's what we're looking at this hour on The Exchange, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. David Moore is with us. He is former head of the Gallup poll, founding director of the UNH Survey Center, and a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at UNH. And David, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Well, thank you very much.
Also with us, Andy Smith, as I said, associate professor of practice in political science and director today of the UNH Survey Center. And Andy, a big welcome back to you, too. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Laura.
Well, and let's just start at the beginning, gentlemen. Andy, just remind us how presidential nominees used to be chosen. Voters had very little to do with it.
Well, actually, there's nothing in the Constitution about how we choose our nominees for president. And early on, the caucuses in Washington were the places where the political parties or the early political parties chose the candidates. And essentially, they would sit around in a room, in a big caucus room, and discuss among themselves as to which candidate they thought would be best representative of their party and have the best chance of winning. So there is essentially zero public involvement in that, other than maybe going back to their home states and feeling out what the political sense was there.
So the smoke-filled room party bosses, that's all true.
Absolutely was true. And then even throughout the 1800s and most of the 1900s, throughout the 1800s, we had national conventions where state parties would send delegates down to the national conventions. But again, those delegates were chosen by the state party themselves. They were not elected. And it wasn't until the Progressive Era started that you started to see states choosing delegates through a public vote to go down there. So 1916 was the first year in which there were any presidential primaries where states voted for delegates for the national conventions. And that was 100 years ago. This is the 100th year of the New Hampshire primary.
And we still have that delegate selection process, even though, right, Andy, those delegates are supposed to reflect what we the people say.
Yes, and that process has changed over the last 100 years. So, for example, in 1968, Hubert Humphrey became the Democratic nominee, and he didn't run in a single primary or a caucus that year. Things changed really after 1968 to make it a much more democratic process.
Well, I'd love your thoughts too, David, just on this idea that up until relatively recently in our history, the average person had zero say in terms of who their nominees would be.
Yes, that's correct. And the reason is that the party leaders essentially controlled the nomination process so that all of the delegates that went to the national convention were basically chosen by the party leaders. There were a few states that had primaries starting starting in the 1900s, but by, 1950, 1960, in those that period of time, there were just a few states with primaries. And a lot of times what would happen is that the candidates would go to those states to demonstrate their electoral appeal. But it wouldn't be a process that would guarantee them the nomination. So even though they may come into the convention with more delegates in a primary than any other, that still wouldn't necessarily mean they would win because the party bosses still control.
That's
the
amazing
process.
To me to yes. read that, someone could come into a national convention with more delegates, David, than the other guy or gal, and it was all guys back then, and still not get the nomination.
Yeah, well, at the time, the political leaders were the ones that were trying to make the decision as to which candidates would be the most appropriate, have the best chance of winning. Now, with the new process that started in 1972, what happens is that each of the candidates has to go around and actually win the delegates. They have to. So once they, for example, when a candidate comes in and wins, say, 50% of the vote here, they'll get 50% of the delegates. Those delegates then are committed to that candidate when they go to the national convention. So in that sense, the voters now have a choice or now have the influence as to which candidates are going to go into the convention with the most delegates. So, and that counts, and that makes a difference.
Without getting into too many dates, so Andy, 100 years ago, the New Hampshire primary starts, 1916. So that stems from Teddy Roosevelt and the whole progressive era.
Right. The earliest states really comes out of Wisconsin, had the first state primary. New Hampshire had its first state primary in 1912. A law was passed in 1913 to have a presidential primary for the 1916 cycle. And it's kind of interesting. How did New Hampshire get to have the first primary? It's really kind of Yankee frugality or cheapness. The original law was to have the primary in May. But some local political leaders say that doesn't make sense. We'd have to open up the town hall twice. Why don't we have it on town meeting day in March?
Since we're open anyway. And the farmers can come.
And the farmers can get there because the roads haven't turned to mud yet. So that's how we got it first. But even in 1916, we didn't have the first primary. A week before that, both Minnesota had it a week before and Indiana had it on the same day. But both of those by 1920 had changed. Minnesota went back to a caucus, and Indiana moved its primary into May. So New Hampshire ended up with the first primary by accident. And we had it for a long period of time. Nobody really paid much attention. And it wasn't really until 1952 that things changed with the presidential primary.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. That's a big turning point. Go ahead, David.
Well, the reason that nobody really understood what was going on is that when the voters voted for the delegates, the delegates weren't necessarily committed to any specific candidate. So
voters voted, but delegates didn't have to do what those voters said.
That's right. And so the voters couldn't.
Which still seems amazing.
Yeah, well, the voters came into the ballot box, and they could vote for delegates that would go to the convention, but they didn't necessarily have the opportunity to vote for a presidential candidate. So they might vote for the governor. They might vote for the outstanding senator to be a delegate. And a lot of times those delegates would say that they're uncommitted. Other times they might say, I'm committed to a candidate, but there was no law that ensured that when they actually got to the convention, they would vote for that candidate because there would be a lot of horse trading at the national convention. And the horse trading would go on because the national party leaders were trying to figure out which is the best candidate that might win.
Yeah, because that's their goal, really, to win.
That was their really goal. But now that it's been the reforms that were adopted in 1972 said that no longer can party leaders choose the delegates that will go to the convention. It's the voters that will have to do it, either through caucus process or through a primary. And that was the big change that occurred that democratized the system, but also brought in all sorts of other disadvantages we can talk about later.
Yeah, lots and lots to talk about. Let me remind our listeners that you can join us, too. The exchange number is 1-800 892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're talking with David Moore and Andrew Smith. They are the co-authors of The First Primary, New Hampshire's Outsized Role in Presidential Nominations. We're finding out how and why New Hampshire got to be first. A little bit later, we'll talk about some of the issues surrounding the primary today, its influence, whether that influence is waning. We'd love to hear from you, your questions, comments, and stories of primaries past. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So a little bit more on this history, and again, this shift from, you know, delegates going to the convention and being able to decide whatever the heck they wanted to having to reflect the will of the voters. I want to play for you now, gentlemen, a little bit of a 1990 interview with Richard Upton, often called the father of the New Hampshire primary. Here he is talking on NHPR. This is when Upton was the Republican Speaker of the New Hampshire House and proposed the changes that made the primary what it would become.
We didn't know how well it would work, but the first time around in 1952, it worked exceedingly well. We had a very spirited contest between General Eisenhower and Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, with Governor Stassen of Minnesota, the third candidate. On the Democratic side, Estes Kefauver, Senator from Tennessee, challenged the incumbent President Truman, and Kefauver developed a style of personal campaigning up and down the streets with his coonskin hat, and he did real well. I think he got the majority of the delegates. So the first time around, it was great.
So again, that's Richard Upton talking on NHPR in 1990. And Andy Smith, when he says it worked well, he means the shocking idea of putting the presidential candidate's name on the ballot. You're no longer voting for, you know, Delegate A or Delegate B. You're voting for, you know, whoever.
Well, actually, you were still voting for the delegates. But what they did was he created what they called the beauty contest,
right,
which gave you the opportunity to express your preference for a presidential candidate by name. But at the same time, it was your vote for the specific delegates, which was still on the ballot, that counted.
Right. So, there were two ballots, essentially. A ballot for the presidential candidates and a separate ballot for the delegates. And now they've been merged so that when you vote for the candidate, it's also the delegates.
But so Upton is talking about the beauty contest there, where you get to express both preferences.
Right. But the one that counted was still the vote for the delegate. That's the official one. That's who went to the convention, was the delegates that you were voting for. So that went on. The thing that about 1952 that he didn't mention was, first off, there was great campaigns, but also it was the advent of television. And so now we've got television, which is like today, they're looking for content. So here, national television can just go up to New Hampshire and see this kind of quaint little tradition that we've had here about this primary in the middle of the winter. But now they've got real candidates and well-known people to follow in that. And that, I think, really started the national attention that the New Hampshire primary had. Prior to that, in the decades before that, largely it was ignored.
All right. We'll talk more about the national media and some of the impressions that it gives of the New Hampshire primary. You can join us, too, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the history of New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary, how it came to be, and how its influence has changed. Our guests are the co-authors of the brand-new book called The First Primary, New Hampshire's Outsized Role in Presidential Nominations. They are David Moore and Andrew Smith, both of UNH. The exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, gentlemen, in a book and in an interview about the New Hampshire primary, I don't want to talk too much, David Moore, about that other contest out in the cornfields of Iowa, but just very briefly, just to remind us how very different a caucus is from a primary, because I think a lot of people think that, you know, it's the same thing.
In the caucus process, there are a lot of meetings around the state. For example, I think in Iowa there are over 2,000 separate caucus meetings. And what happens is that people come in the evening and they talk about the candidates. And at the end of the evening, they vote and to say which of the delegates there at the caucus will go to the next higher level, the county caucuses, which will be held maybe a month later, and which candidates they support. And then at the county caucuses, they elect delegates that go into the congressional congressional caucuses. And then finally, they have a state caucus that may happen, you know, 3 to 4 months later. And what happened with Iowa is that Iowa used to hold its caucuses in the spring. But once the new laws came out, the new reform in the Democratic Party, Democratic Party said, okay, in order for us to be open about this and allow anybody who wants to be a delegate an opportunity to show up, we've got to start our caucuses way back in February, which is...
So they bumped ahead in New Hampshire, which is in March.
But at that point, it didn't matter because nobody was covering the caucuses anyway. Nobody knew that Iowa would become important. So they started in February, which was before New Hampshire, and that accident in 1972, that accident, you know, came by just because they needed the time, was something that Iowa recognized, just as New Hampshire did. Oh, this is very good. We get a lot of media attention, so let's make sure that we keep that.
Andy Smith, sometimes when I explain to people the difference between a caucus and a primary, and the media kind of conflates the two, here are the results, here are the results, people often say to me, wow, you know, I had no idea that it was so undemocratic, but unrepresentative. I mean, only a couple people show up to these things.
In Iowa, you have turnout typically in 7 to 9% range. So it's a very low turnout.
And yet it's conflated with the New Hampshire primary.
It is, in part because it's usually in the evenings, like from 7 o'clock to 9 or 10 o'clock at night. As David was describing, the Democratic side, they have a very public process where there's actually speeches and discussions and so forth. The Republican caucus in Iowa is much more like a primary, but it's still a short window when it's open. If you want to vote in the Republican caucus in Iowa, you basically show up, get your ballot, vote. You can stick around for the meeting if you want to, but a lot of people just vote and leave. So it is different. But I think the important part that David mentions is that we don't know at the end of the day, on the end of election day for the Iowa caucuses, which candidate actually wins the most delegates, because the actual delegates to the national convention won't be selected until June. So we have an idea of the direction that things are going. We can see who won the popular vote in Iowa, but we don't know really what the delegate selection is going to look like until June.
How much, Andy, does what happens in Iowa influence what happens in New Hampshire a couple days or a couple weeks later?
Surprisingly, not too much. I use it on the Republican side. There's not been a Republican candidate, other than a sitting president, who's won both the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary in the same year.
Wow. So on the Republican side, we often choose differently
always
from our friends in Iowa.
Always choose differently. And it's because the electorates are very different. The Iowa Republican electorate is very evangelical. It's dominated by church organizations, very socially conservative, whereas the Republican electorate in New Hampshire is moderate to liberal for the most part. About 45% identify as moderate to liberal. And it's a northeastern kind of Rockefeller Republican electorate, very different.
How about on the Democratic side, Doug?
Well, let's go back to the Republican side. I agree with Andy about the difference in the vote, but I think what happens in Iowa is that they also tend to screed out a lot of the candidates. So, for example, in 1988, it was in 1984, there were a whole bunch of Republican candidates. And what happened is that just two won. So, you know, what happens is that Iowa helps to screen out all of the lesser candidates. On the Democratic side, the Iowa Democrats are probably about as liberal about as are the New Hampshire Democrats, so that a lot of times there will be an agreement between the two states. For example, when Kerry won in 2004, that was a big deal. He won in Iowa and therefore won in New Hampshire. But there are also times when there have been different. In 1988, it was Gephardt winning, but eventually Dukakis won in New Hampshire. So you can't always tell, but what happens in Iowa isn't necessarily going to happen in New Hampshire.
And I think a good part of that is because in both states now, they have real campaigns that are run. The other states after New Hampshire, with maybe a smaller exception of South Carolina, are really dependent upon what happens in Iowa and in New Hampshire to give them cues about who to vote for. But in New Hampshire and Iowa, you have ongoing campaigns for at least a year before the actual votes are taken. So voters there are familiar with the candidates. They have real campaigns, very strong campaign organizations in those states, whereas the other states just don't have that.
Well, it's fascinating what you guys write about in the book. The interplay between Iowa and New Hampshire, who wins in one place isn't always who wins in the other, how the states influence each other, how they don't. I want to play a little piece of sound now from 2008, and you gentlemen know where I'm going with this. This is when Hillary Clinton lost to Barack Obama in Iowa. That was a big upset, and then won in New Hampshire in 2008. Let's hear Hillary Clinton's victory speech in 2008.
I felt like we all spoke from our hearts, and I am so gratified that you responded. Now, together, let's give America the kind of comeback that New Hampshire has just given me.
Again, that's Hillary Clinton winning the New Hampshire primary in 2008. Andy Smith, talk a little bit more about that. That was a big upset for several reasons.
Big upset certainly for pollsters because us and every other polling organization predicted that Barack Obama would win. It was a unique year in that the Iowa caucuses in 2008 were only 5 days before the New Hampshire primary. And when Obama won the Iowa caucuses, he got a big media boost nationally as well as in New Hampshire. And I think that media boost, that little bubble, needed some time to work its way out. Unfortunately, we can't stay in the field polling that late. So those, and I think it points out something very important about New Hampshire, is that those last-minute campaign events really make a difference, or can make a difference in a state like New Hampshire. Exit polls have shown year after year that upwards of 30 to 45% of voters make up their minds over the last weekend, and 15 to 20% make up their minds on election day. So I think that's a critical thing to remember about New Hampshire. In 2008 illustrated it, that those last-minute efforts by campaigns and those last-minute events really can make a difference.
Well, and she used the word comeback. And go ahead, yeah, David. That's a very carefully chosen word there.
Yeah, it was, because, of course, in 1992, when Bill Clinton was running for president, he was hurt by allegations, not so much about Jennifer Flowers, but by allegations about trying to avoid the draft. And suddenly his numbers really plummeted, and Paul Tsongas was the front runner. But he came in second and called himself the comeback kid, and therefore, you know, was able to go on and win the nomination. But use of the comeback kid was something that obviously Hillary Clinton was referring to when she talked about her own comeback.
Well, and somebody else used those words, comeback or comeback kid. Here's John McCain, also in 2008, mm-hmm. upon winning the New Hampshire primary. Let's hear from Senator McCain.
Friends, you know, I'm past the age when I can claim the noun kid, no matter what adjective precedes it. But tonight, we sure showed them what a comeback looks like.
Again, that's Senator John McCain winning the New Hampshire primary in 2008. What's also important, Andy, correct me if I'm wrong, about that 1992 comeback kid, even though Bill Clinton came in second to Paul Tsongas, most people think he won the New Hampshire primary. That's the first time, right, Andy, that the person who eventually won the White House had not won New Hampshire?
First time in the modern modern nomination cycle that was true.
Since 1952, right.
Right. And I think that the McCain thing, it really points out something about the New Hampshire primary and about the nomination processes in general, is that McCain was dead by the middle of 2008. People had written him off.
I remember that.
But he stayed up here and campaigned, had a good organization, and he waited for other events and other candidates essentially to have their moment in the sun and then fall by the wayside. And he ended up being the candidate there at the end. And I think that's important to think about when we're looking at this year's cycle, where you've got currently Donald Trump leading on the Republican side, is that the summer of 2007, it was Rudy Giuliani or Mitt Romney that are leading. The person who's leading in the summer often is not the person who ends up winning.
Another thing to keep in mind about John McCain is that he won in 2000, even though George W. Bush was the establishment favorite, and George W. Bush eventually went on to win the nomination. But in New Hampshire in 2000, it was McCain who won. So winning again in 2008 was essentially a replay of what he had done 8 years earlier.
I have to ask you about Rudy Giuliani, Andy, since you mentioned it. He famously skipped New Hampshire, had his Florida strategy. People say it came back to bite him. Is that true?
I think absolutely. See, one of the things that the whole nomination cycle is designed to do is identify a candidate who can win. And how do you determine if you're a voter who's a winner and who's a loser? Well, winners win and losers lose. By the time Florida came around, Giuliani had already lost 4 or 5 contests. So he was already.
The machine was off.
It was off. Voters weren't looking at him as a winner. They were paying attention to the people who had won contests before that, and that being John McCain. And that strategy, I think, was a losing strategy. It's important to point out that there's only been one candidate since 1972 who has won the presidency without winning either New Hampshire or Iowa, and that was, again, Bill Clinton in 1992.
Wow. Okay. Go ahead, David, and then let's go to our listeners.
Okay. Well, skipping Iowa and New Hampshire is what Al Gore did in 1988. He was counting on the Southern primaries, and so he—
Right. I forgot about that.
So yeah. He found out that all he did was skip the first 2 contests. Rudy Giuliani skipped the first 4 or 5 contests. But even Al Gore skipping Iowa and New Hampshire, by skipping it, I mean he competed, but he didn't really put much effort into it. And waiting until the Southern primary didn't work for him, it was much too late. So, yeah, I think it's really dangerous for any candidate to have a plan where they're going to skip the first 2 contests and think they can win the nomination.
Still, David, you think that's still the case, even with everything so nationalized and, you know, television-driven?
Well, we don't know for sure because, you know, it's easier predicting the past than it is predicting the future. I would think that still the amount of publicity that the candidates will get from the first 2 contests is invaluable. So I wouldn't bet on any candidate skipping it.
The exchange phone number for you to join us with David Moore and Andrew Smith as we talk about the first primary and their new book on the subject, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, let's go to our listeners. Martin's in Concord. Hi, Martin. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hello, Laura. How are you?
Fine.
Good. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks to your guests. I haven't yet read their book because it's just out, I guess, today, but I look forward to reading it. I have been involved in defending the New Hampshire primary from the depredations or the threats of the National Democratic Party for over a period of years, particularly in the 80s, and that was the subject of some scholarly looks by a couple of professors back then. I'm looking forward to reading this one because this will be another scholarly look by some homegrown folks, not just outsiders who come in and tell us what we've been doing. But I did want to underscore the friction that exists between the national parties, at least on the Democratic side, and our efforts to keep the primary first. The spectacular fight occurred in 1984 when we insisted on being first, and we were outside the so-called window that for primaries that the National Democratic Party had set up. And the Democratic National Chairman threatened not to seat our delegates at the convention. And it got that bad. Finally, we were able to through some, I guess, artistic politicking, work our way around that. And our delegates were, after all, seated, and we did hold the first primary. But that was just one example. In 88, there was another struggle. So this has not been a popular primary with the national folks. And I think in the Republican side, although I can only be an outside observer, I see the way they have scheduled debates and done other things. They don't particularly care for our role either.
Martin, I'm so glad you called because this is a big theme in the book about this friction between the state parties in New Hampshire and Iowa and the national party. And it's so important to talk about this, Andy Smith. Go ahead.
First off, we have to thank Bill Gardner and Jim Splaine, I think, for writing legislation that makes the state keep its first primary. We have to, by law, move our primary before any other state. But that doesn't stop the national party from not liking it.
So why don't they like it? What's their problem?
Well, part of it is that a lot of people think that New Hampshire is too small, too white,
not representative of the rest of the country, has too big of an influence for the size of the state to have that much influence. So other states feel that they should have more influence. And, you know, that's a good argument, but history has been on the side of New Hampshire. The thing that happened in 84, which is, I think, is a fascinating thing that we talk about in the book, is that there was a Democratic state quasi-convention that was held over at Southern New Hampshire University that year, in which all of the delegates or all of the candidates came and were going to speak. But before they went on stage, they were brought into the back room, to a green room, and they were given a letter to sign in which they indicated their support for New Hampshire's first in the nation role, et cetera. And it was essentially blackmail.
Wow.
And George Bruno, who was the Democratic chair at the time, was involved with this. So essentially all but one of them signed. Reuben Askew didn't sign. But they had to, because they had to sign this letter. And if they didn't sign the letter, all of the Democrats in the audience would be told which one wasn't signing the letter. So it was blackmail to keep people in there. So we've resorted to a lot of trickery and political arm twisting to keep the primary first.
Well, and Bill Gardner, our New Hampshire Secretary of State, being the arm twister in chief, if I could put it that way. Here's Bill Gardner being interviewed by NHPR's Brady Carlson earlier this year, remembering that 1984 incident that Martin and you talked about, Andy, where Bill Gardner had to fend off national Democratic efforts to make New Hampshire part of a regional presidential primary.
And at that time, it was a woman, Nancy Pelosi, who had never held a public office. She came to New Hampshire and with a couple of attorneys from the DNC and just basically said that, you know, we better have the primary on that date or our primary will be irrelevant and we better change the date.
Wow. So why, Andy answered this too, but I love your thoughts too, David. Why don't national party people like New Hampshire? What do they have against us?
Well, they don't like New Hampshire because they don't like the outsized role that it plays in the nomination process, given its small size. And there's so many other states who believe that they should have that same opportunity.
Like Michigan.
Yeah, Michigan was
they're always mad about the primary.
They're always mad about that. But I think if you look at it from an objective point of view, as though, say, you're not from New Hampshire, you might say, yeah, why should New Hampshire be first? There is no, I think, compelling reason for New Hampshire to be first compared to the other states, except that if you try to come up with a process that says which state should go first and which should not, if you want a national primary, there's so many other arguments against it that it's difficult not to just keep with what we've got.
So it's not perfect, but what do you replace it with?
That's exactly
the problem.
Yeah, that's the problem.
All right, Martin, thank you so much for calling in. More of your calls, questions, and comments in just a moment. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with the co-authors of a brand new book called The First Primary, New Hampshire's Outsized Role in Presidential Nominations. Our guests are David Moore, senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy and founding director of the UNH Survey Center. Also, Andy Smith, associate professor of practice in political science and director of the UNH Survey Center. The book is just out this week. Again, it's called The First Primary, New Hampshire's Outsized Role in Presidential Nominations. We're taking your questions, comments, stories, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, right back to our listeners, and Steve's calling in Bedford. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for putting me on so fast. I haven't heard this discussed yet. I've been listening very intently, and that is the impact and influence of independently registered voters in New Hampshire. As I understand it, like 40% of the voters in New Hampshire call themselves independents, and, you know, a lot of us really aren't. So when the primary time comes around, we pick up the ballot that has the most fun, that has the most decisions to be made. Right?
Are you a mischief voter, Steve?
I'll pick up a Republican ballot this time for sure, okay, and probably vote for the person that I hate the most.
Mischief voting, Steve. That's what they call it. Mischief voting.
Well, I don't know how mischievous it is. It's certainly allowable, and I'm trying to help my cause. So if that's mischief, well, I wonder how much influence that has and if other states have the same thing going on.
I'm so glad you called, Steve. And Andy Smith, I know you are too, because the independent voter comes under the category myth in this book.
Right.
So in New Hampshire, you can be registered as a Republican, a Democrat, or undeclared. Now, we unfortunately call those people who are registered undeclared independents, and it's about 40% of the electorate. It varies a little bit from election to election. But the national media and some campaigns look at that group as a pot of voters that are up for grabs by either primary, and we often hear the story about which candidate is going to get the independent voters. Is it going to be Bill Bradley or John McCain in 2000, or is it going to be Barack Obama and John McCain in 2008? Where are they going to go? But the reality is those undeclared voters, for the most part, are either Republicans or Democrats. Only about 30% of them are truly up for grabs.
30%?
Only about 30% of the undeclared voters. And of that 30%, very few vote, because those people who are truly independent, not affiliated with one party or the other, generally don't follow politics that much. And they vote in a presidential election, but not typically in the primaries. Scholars have looked at this, and they found that upwards of 85% of those undeclared voters vote consistently in the same primary. So they always vote in the Republican primary or always vote in the Democratic primary.
So why do they bother being undeclared?
Well, there's advantages, as Stephen indicated. Suppose it's a year where your party is not having a primary. Let's say like in 2012. If you're a Democrat in 2012, there's no primary. You can come out and vote in the Democratic primary anyway just to show your support for your president. But you could go vote in the primary where there's some action. You could be like Steve and say, go vote for the candidate you like the least to cause some mischief. But even that doesn't happen that often. Typically, even in those other years, people vote in the same primary. But the big advantage for being undeclared is it gives you that flexibility. You aren't publicly identified as a partisan one way or the other. It allows you to maintain the self-view that maybe you are politically independent. You vote for the candidate, not the party. And there's really no cost to it. It's easy to change your vote, registration back to undeclared as you leave the polling place. In the past, it wasn't so easy, but it is now.
What do you think, David? Why every 4 years do sort of national anchors intone that the independent vote is up for grabs in New Hampshire and, prognosticate on who's going to get that independent vote?
Well, it's not only the independent voters. It's the quirky independent voters makes it a wonderful story. And so the media like to keep focusing on that. I was talking with Andy just about a week or so ago, and we were trying to keep tabs of the number of times we read in the national media or in some kind of news story that you've got the quirky New Hampshire independent voters, and they're so unpredictable and things of that nature.
So it's a better story.
It's a better story. But when you start doing a systematic comparison of the voters in New Hampshire, that is their level of knowledge and things of that nature and their commitment, it's not that much different from other states with similar demographic kinds of situations. The difference is that New Hampshire gets a lot of the candidates early on. If other states had the same kind of experience, their voters would then be quirky and independent and, all these other kinds of colorful descriptions that they like.
Just one more point about the independent voters in New Hampshire. Here, they're legally undeclared. That's the term for them. In Massachusetts, about 55% of the voters in that state are registered unaffiliated. That's their term for it. We don't think of Massachusetts as a state filled with independent voters.
Or quirky voters
who could jump ship
either way. Right. All right. Well, Steve, it's a great question. Thank you so much for calling in. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Wayne is in Dover. Hi, Wayne. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Thank you for the program today.
Sure.
I had two questions for you and your panel. First one, I wondered if any of you knew a candidate that had been on the primary ballot the most times in their respective party. You had mentioned Harold Stassen earlier. I remember him being a perennial candidate. And my second question is kind of a continuation of your earlier discussion. Is there a candidate out there that you think might have put too much effort in New Hampshire and didn't look forward or backward enough in the whole nominating process?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. So the first one, a little primary Trivial Pursuit almost, who's been on the ballot the most amount of times. You guys probably don't have that at your fingertips, but are there people who have been on multiple times?
The problem with New Hampshire is that it's so easy to get on the ballot here. It costs you $1,000 and you have to qualify legally. You have to be 35 years old and born in the United States. There are a lot of people who are fringe candidates who have run multiple times in New Hampshire. But a major candidate, Stassen, might be the most of anyone's.
Anybody else come to mind? David?
I can't think of anyone else offhand because the candidates that run most often are the ones that are probably least interesting. So, you know, you just don't pay too much attention to them.
But I love his second question, too, David. We talked earlier about, like, Rudy Giuliani skipping New Hampshire for that Florida strategy. You mentioned David Al Gore with his Southern strategy, and both times it backfired. Wayne asks the opposite question. Is there anybody who's put too much effort in New Hampshire at the expense of...
Of course not. How could expense anyone suggest such a thing?
Of other states.
Yeah.
Like Joe Lieberman moved here.
Yeah.
I think it was 2000 or 2004, and that didn't really serve him well.
I think when you get candidates who essentially move here and live here, it's usually because they're very weak and they don't have much of a campaign outside the state.
So banking it all on New Hampshire.
Yeah, and so I wouldn't blame the fact that they moved here for their loss, subsequent loss, but rather that's an indication that they're a weak candidate to start off with.
I see. You want to jump in, Andy?
I really can't think of a candidate that's a major candidate who went on to win or should have won, who banked everything on New Hampshire. The political science literature on this really shows that of all of the states, any of the states, but especially the early states, New Hampshire is by far the most significant one. It has the greatest impact on whether you win the nomination or not, much more than Iowa.
All right, let's take some emails, gentlemen. Here's a few that just came in. This is from a Manchester listener, didn't give a name. How about rotating the primary so that there isn't this outsize emphasis on New Hampshire? David, do you want to take that? I know that's an idea that's come up.
Yeah, well, there have been a lot of reform ideas. But if
regional primaries, national primaries?
Regional primaries, actually rotating the primaries so that one state would not necessarily always have the primary position. But then you have to figure out, okay, which states? How are you going to rotate it? The problem is that none of the parties can't come to an agreement as to what would be a fair process and what states would you rotate it with. Do you want to rotate it with just small states so that there can be the one-on-one campaigning? Or are you going to rotate it with large states where it's only media? What order, you know, and how often is it going to change? There have been proposals, and we discuss them in the book. The Delaware plan was one, and there are other plans that have tried to come up with that. But the main problem is that the political parties can't come to an agreement among the states as a consensus as to what would be a better process than the one that we've got. And as a consequence, the status quo continues to be in action.
And I would say the status quo actually is even more firm now than it has been in the past. For the first time, the Republican Party changed its rules to specifically exempt the four early states of Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada to be outside the window. So in the past, the Democrats have done things like this, but the Republicans have just kind of gone along with what the Democrats did. Now we're at the point where it's being solidified in Republican rules as well. And once you get these things into rules and then they play out, the candidates and the parties get used to the system. And once people get used to the system, they don't really want to change it.
Wow. So you have all this sort of push-pull. I mean, some of the national party leaders, as both of you have said, Andy, don't like New Hampshire. They don't think it's representative, or they want to control the process. They don't want New Hampshire voters to control the process. But then you have the candidates themselves, some of whom like the system. You got the media, which is used to it. You know, let's go to New Hampshire. It's a nice place. So it's kind of all – you have all this push-pull going on.
Well, the candidates say they like it because they're essentially – blackmailed into saying that. In other words, maybe not blackmailed, but they're certainly pressured. You can't, if you're going to change the process, you usually change it 4 years in advance. So if candidates come to New Hampshire, they're not going to say, I don't want New Hampshire to be the first primary, because that's, you know, that's just, you know, political suicide. So it's very difficult to get them to agree to a change 4 years in advance.
No big threats this year, then, gentlemen. In the past, it seems like every 4 years or at least 8 years is a big threat. This year, Andy, seems like all is quiet on this front.
There's still a couple things, and it's not so much a threat to New Hampshire. It's usually a threat to some of the other states that follow. So Florida wants to be the first Southern primary and bump South Carolina out of the way. North Carolina this year has changed their laws, so they're really close to South Carolina. But what happens is, say, South Carolina moves its primary up, which means then New Hampshire has to move its up by state law. We have to be a week before any earlier, similar contest. And then Iowa then moves its up because it has to be a week before New Hampshire. So it's not usually pressure on New Hampshire per se. It's pressure on the other states are at the tail end of the window. And I think that's that'll be less of a problem this year because of that solidification of the rules and the penalties that the parties have put in against states that violate the window are stronger this year than they have been. Although I should say that, you know, New Hampshire gets 20 to 30 delegates depending on the party. Those 20 to 30 delegates are meaningless in who actually is going to win the nomination. And even for a state that's somewhat larger, like a Utah, for example, has made some noises about moving theirs up earlier, their delegates don't really determine who the president is going to be. It's the spot in line that would give Utah, in this case, power.
It's all about the calendar. All right, let's go back to our listeners. And Rick's joining us from Hopkinton. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm just primarily looking at this whole thing as I have over the years, born and raised in the state. Not going to mention my age, but I've been through numerous elections and watched this go for many years. And I can't help but notice one of the effects of the order of events of the election in the primary is that voter participation declines week by week as more and more states see or feel that their vote may be relatively useless because the election is pretty much already determined. And I'm wondering why we don't just all vote on the same day. It would make more sense. We have the capability now, unlike years ago when the system was developed, and you would have, I think, better voter participation.
Rick, thanks for calling in. And also an email from Franny in Concord says, what would be the problem with a national primary? Seems like Franny says it would be a much fairer setup. What do you guys think, David?
Well, national primary has a lot of advantages because everybody can vote at the same time. But it also requires the candidates to have a lot of money and to be able to, and they would have to campaign, presumably they would campaign nationally. And the whole idea of the New Hampshire, Iowa, New Hampshire, and the small states starting first is that it forces the candidates to go out and meet the voters one-on-one. If you start off with a national primary, it's going to be a media primary right from the beginning.
Isn't that what it is now, though, kind of anyway? I mean, not to be cynical, but, you know, a lot of it's media-driven, debate-driven, how much money you have to buy ads on TV and so forth.
Well, absolutely, even in New Hampshire. On the other hand, the candidates do have to get out and meet the voters. And I think the dynamics of the process are such that it's not the same as a national media election would be.
Yeah, that's one of the myths about the New Hampshire primary, but there's a nugget of truth. Here we have this idea that you have to meet a candidate four or five times before you decide if you're going to vote for him. And it is true that we have really high numbers of people who actually go out and meet a candidate. Back in 2008, it was upwards about 15% to 18% of adults in the state said they had shaken hands with one of the candidates that year.
Never mind gone to an event and seen them from afar.
But that means that about 80% plus haven't.
Right.
Done that. So we do have higher participation than any other state, even higher than Iowa. We have higher turnout. We have more people that actually see a candidate. So there is a great bit of truth to the idea that there is one-on-one campaigning going on in New Hampshire, and it really doesn't go on in any other state.
What about the money, gentlemen? A lot of folks feel like the New Hampshire primary is no longer unique because of all the outside money that, you know, again, leads to the advertising on TV. And boy, your mailbox, I know mailboxes are old-fashioned, but they're still stuffed with campaign material. How has all this money changed the nature of the New Hampshire primary, Andy?
Money is necessary, but having the most money doesn't guarantee you a win. Steve Forbes would have been the Republican nominee in 1996 if that were the case. Hillary Clinton had more money than Obama throughout a lot of 2007, but she wasn't the nominee in 2008. John McCain certainly didn't have much money in 2008, and he was able to win the nomination. That is changing somewhat now because of outside money and the ability for any candidate to have a super PAC set up and have a couple wealthy people fund that super PAC to keep them going. I think the increase in money actually kind of democratizes money a bit in that you don't have to be the candidate with the biggest organization and the most political strength now. You can be a candidate who has a good idea and maybe is a good candidate, largely unknown, and have enough money to keep you going by having a super PAC out there.
I think it also affects the impact of the New Hampshire primary. It used to be that if you didn't win in New Hampshire and Iowa, you know, your candidacy was dead. But now with the outside money, it's possible, we don't know yet, and we'll see in this new cycle, it's possible that candidates can continue to campaign because they'll have the money from one or two billionaires or, you know, multimillionaires that would keep them going. So I think the money probably will change the impact of the New Hampshire primary, but we won't know until we see what happens this election cycle.
All right, both of you, this has been great. Good luck with the book. Thank you so much for being here, and we'll see what happens over the next couple months.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Oh, thank you.
The book is The First Primary. It's just out, New Hampshire's Outsized Role in Presidential Elections. The authors are David Moore, Senior Fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy and Founding Director of the UNH Survey Center. Also, Andy Smith, Associate Professor of Practice in Political Science and Director of the UNH Survey Center. By the way, NHPR, of course, is closely covering the primary. You can find links to all kinds of stories, including today's on the role of independent voters, on NHPR.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.